Thank you very much, Vice Chancellor. I appreciate your comments, and it is indeed true that for me, coming to Sussex was a life fulfillment, and I've never one minute regretted that I came here. But at some point, of course, homesickness sets in, and that is why my topic of tonight, which is transnational classes and global political economy, has a subtitle, The Anglo-Dutch Connection, because that will give me some chance to talk about Holland in connection with my new place of residence. It also will allow me to correct a remark that I once made to John Dearlove when he asked me, what would you say is the typical characteristic of the Dutch? And I must have had too much to drink, or I don't know what, but I said courage. And I always regretted that, but I thought it was a bit pedantic and over the top to actually send him an email and apologize and explain, etc. So I thought there will come a day when I'll have a chance to put this in perspective. So if there are a few quotes in my lecture which actually refer to the Dutch national character, they are to set this right. And I hope John at the end will appreciate that this was not a malicious boasting on my part. Now, there is, of course, also the topic itself, transnational classes. And my experience has been that, certainly in the social sciences, the choice of topic tends to be much more autobiographical than you often assume when you think of non-fiction. Because, I can't speak of my direct colleagues now, because it would cast a shadow over the reception. But it is true if you go over them and you look at the topics that they have worked on through their career, you always see an element of their personality coming through the particular topic and the way they have handled it. In my case, it is certainly true that class is something that I was born with, so to speak, because I was born in a small butcher shop, well, not actually in the shop, but of course, one story higher. After that, I landed in the student corps, which in Holland is a sort of upper class network. After that, I went to military service, and I was an officer of the Dutch military police. And finally, I ended up in the Communist Party, which my mother always implored me never to mention in public under any circumstance. Now, in all these cases, and I don't want to give a heroic twist to that experience, because as I passed through these different environments, I was dazed and dazzled, and in each of them, as the Dutch say, I had my ears washed as the naive person who didn't understand what things were about. But looking back on it, I may say that that gave me, it made me something like a tourist in the class structure, if you will. Because in the petty bourgeoisie in which I was born, we lived in constant fear of the working class and in deep admiration of the ruling class. I think I sum it up in fairness to my parents. In the upper class, there was the typical scorn of the petty bourgeoisie, on the other hand. You know, the working class didn't even exist for these people. But the people who dressed wrongly, and the people who had the wrong tie and the wrong shoes, etc., they were a source of constant amusement. In the officer corps, on the other hand, these were people from the provincial elite. And what worried them most was really the city and everything that it stood for. The deep sinfulness of the city was a topic of endless fascination of the officers when we were convening in the mess. Sometimes, in my naivete, I even thought that what they really were expressing was a deep wish to go there, but they didn't dare to. And in the Communist Party, finally, I discovered for the first time what you might call a scientific attempt to understand the other classes. And I think somehow that has remained with me. I always feel that was a formative experience, although, as I said before, it's not something that everybody would be extremely proud of necessarily. But I never was ashamed of it, although I saw the hopeless sectarianism and certainly the petty bourgeois leadership of that party, which took away some of the fantastic experience of being with class-conscious workers who were people that proved to me for the first time that it was possible to actually overcome these distinctions of class. Now, I think that's enough for autobiographical reference. Let me tell you what I want to talk about tonight. Transnational classes, in my view, are the category that help us understand how a system of territorially sovereign and self-enclosed states can coexist in the same structure of power with a world economy which tendentially spills over these borders. You know, these are two different universes. The transnational class is not a social force which exists at sea or something. You know, they have to be somewhere, so they are in Holland or in England, because these are the countries that I'll be talking about. But they have to have a conception of the larger social space in which they move, which cannot be confined to the national state. That is the central idea of a transnational class. And what I will do is to go over briefly three episodes in which this aspect of the creation of a transnationality, the creation of a new sphere in which social forces move without being constrained by territorial seclusion, basically between Holland and England. The first one is Thomas More and Erasmus. The second one is Freemasonry. And the third one is the recent developments in terms of the international networks of joint directors. And for that, I have received the help of Or Raviv, who also helped me with putting together my slideshow, which is an experiment for me, and it's a bit, it's also, I'm not used to using notes normally, but this is like moving from solo performance to playing in a band. And to make sure that I have the right text at the right slide, I have to consult my notes from time to time. Now, in the case of Thomas More and Erasmus, we're looking at a period in history in which the world has suddenly opened in a very radical way. We're talking about the discovery of the Americas by European, mostly Mediterranean, sailors working for Iberian power holders, although the English, of course, also sent an explorer of their own very early on who found Newfoundland. That world was new, it was wide. It also coincided, and I think that must have been a coincidence, with the end of the age of the medieval fighters. If we think of the date 1500, which is the date that I'm starting with, we're really looking at a period in which, at the end of the Hundred Years' War and the end of the War of the Roses, which were the internecine struggles between various houses of English nobles, you see a sort of massive slaughter, a process in which one group is constantly beheading the other, of course with new recruits being mobilized all along. And that decimates a class which would have been totally superfluous in the period that followed, because the warrior aristocracy had no longer a place in the world that was to come. There was another decimation that had taken place, and that was the decimation by the plague in the 14th century already. And the 14th century, and that disaster that the plague was for Britain, it was even more of a disaster than on the European continent, because the rate of people dying from it was higher. That led in Britain to the impossibility to subordinate the people who worked on the land. So there was an impossibility to actually conserve the feudal relations of exploitation on the land. And that again triggered processes which I here have to sum up very briefly, culminating in the process of triggering the process of enclosure, which was the transformation of arable land into sheep pastures. And one of the first people who actually wrote a very sharp critique of that process, of course, was Thomas More, because in Thomas More's Utopia, we read the famous line about the gentle sheep of England having become so ferocious that they now eat the people. You know, that was, in my old days, I thought that Marx had come up with that, but he only quoted Thomas More, because Thomas More was really upset. Thomas More had been a witness to the last phase of the Wars of the Roses and the Hundred Years' War, and he was a confidant of the circle around the new king or the new royal house of the Tudors. And it was for Henry the Eighth Tudor that he was sent to Antwerp at some point to act as a... and now I come to my first plate. To act as a diplomat in trade frictions with Charles V. Well, there are some 50 names involved in the whole web of interest that was involved here, but basically you might say Holland and Flanders with it were part of Burgundy. Burgundy had become part of the German Empire, although it used to have, it formerly was a part of the French, well, the agglomeration of French duchies and counties that was forming itself into the French state. And More was now sent for Henry the Eighth to negotiate with the representatives of the German Empire about frictions concerning the wool export. And you see Thomas More here in the middle. I thought this was a nice illustration because it gives us a bit of a sense of the period. And so many people, even some of my most respected colleagues, often use the word capitalism to speak about this period. And I thought an illustration like this will remind us that we are talking of a time when the dynamism, the free markets, the openness, the permanence of competition really was not around, because people are sitting here very relaxed. And next to Thomas More, you can actually see his father. And Thomas More was here in his 50s. His father must have been, well, you can calculate yourself. So people lived long, they lived very slowly, and, well, at some point, of course, they died. And the interesting thing here now is that the form in which this is drawn is also itself a sign of the new world, because this is really the Renaissance. It's a drawing by Holbein. It's a sketch. You can see that he has indicated who he is drawing to negotiate, of course, with the people who paid him to do this afterwards. And this is a form of drawing which you wouldn't have seen in the Middle Ages. You know, the Middle Ages in this respect were really finished. We are now moving to a stage in which people are depicted as reality demands. So it's really a fascinating work of art, which is very meaningful. Now, Thomas More wrote the Utopia, first to protest over the enclosures and the terrible social consequences that he saw happening in them, and also to protest to Cardinal Wolsey, one of the power holders, the actual Lord Chancellor at the time, who had offered him a post in the Privy Council, and he wanted to refuse that. More didn't want to have anything to do with a society which was treating its subject so brutally. After he returned from Antwerp, where he had met Erasmus, by the way, he dedicated his life to the service of the king, nevertheless, and at some point, of course, we all know that he ended up himself as Lord Chancellor, which is a very crucial post, because it's the confessor of the king who tells the king about the limits of his prerogatives. And when Henry VIII, well, we might say privatized the church lands in 1534, it was More who protested. So More was upset and expressed that in his Utopia about the social changes that were taking place that had to do with the beginnings of capitalism, the privatization of land in all kinds of ways, the exposure of the mass of the population to the labor market. And he wanted, therefore, to sketch a world that was completely different from the one he was seeing. More wanted to restore the idea of social protection. So the conclusions that he drew from the world that he described in the Utopia were conservative. He wanted to go back to a world where people enjoyed the feudal protection of the lord and would not be exposed. And it was something like that which you also find in his friend Erasmus. Erasmus is here. This is drawn by Albrecht Dürer, with Holbein, the great Renaissance German draftsman. And Erasmus is the one whom I can quote in my, the side project that I'm doing here, which is to get straight with John Dearlove, because Erasmus says something about the Dutch, which is not a compliment. And if I can find it here. He says, "The Dutch are a mean, uncivilized type of people with a massive disdain for the sciences, not a single product of learning, and a frightening envy." That was the judgment that Erasmus gave of the Dutch. Now, he was extremely bitter, and some people have said that because he was the bastard son of a priest, and he was pestered about that at school, that he may therefore have had a more negative view of the Dutch than he might otherwise have had. And after he became a very successful diplomat and, counselor of kings, he actually came back once to Holland, and he softened his judgment a little bit and said that when he visited Brabant, which is the province next to what is now Belgium, he said, "The old barbarism still has stubborn advocates." And I must say, in all honesty, that although I'm a patriot, that would also be my judgment about the Dutch of today, but there are some more coming later in the talk. Now, Erasmus was, like More, somebody who lived in this new space that was sketched in the Utopia, a new space which was created by the discoveries of the Americas, as I said, and the discoveries of the Americas were an event that forced people to rethink what the position of their own society and themselves was in this enlarged space. More's was not the only utopia. There is a whole series of writings of that type, you know, culminating, if you will, in Gulliver's Travels by Swift, who draws it, of course, entirely on the satirical plane. But in the case of More, it was a very serious enterprise. And actually, after he had been to Antwerp and returned to England, he wrote the final part of it, in which he made a number of recommendations about the new foreign policy that England should undertake once it was reordered according to his recommendations. And for instance, he says somewhere that the Utopians, which are a fictitious people about which his fictitious Flemish seafarer relates, the Utopians go to war cautiously and reluctantly, only to protect their own territory and that of their friends if an enemy has invaded it. And then you get a very interesting early sign of how the English saw their foreign policy and the ethical motivations behind it, or to free some wretched people from tyrannous oppression and servitude. And of course, that is still today the reason why so many terrible crimes are committed overseas. And actually, my mind wanders now to one of our PhD students who has gone missing, who is an Iraqi, Adil Ali, and who wrote about the connections between Iraq and its neighbors, but from whom we have not heard since he last reported for duty some half year ago. And what I've heard is that he may have actually gone back. And if you think about that, then you can also think about the conclusion that two authors that I've written down here, Wolfers and Martin, who write about the English-speaking tradition, the Anglo-American tradition in foreign policy, when they say that what sets apart the Anglo-American tradition in world politics is a philosophy of choice which was bound to be ethical over against a philosophy of necessity, which they say is typical of the continent. So More was, on the one hand, a critic of the society of his day. He was an active diplomat. He was a fierce critic of the social changes that were taking place. At the same time, he formulated, unwittingly you might say, or maybe in a sort of unreflected reflex, some of the principles that would take English foreign policy onto roads that in the end would prove very problematic for the rest of the world, but which of course have a lot to do with the developing commercial society. Erasmus is a guy like More. He too is a man who converses with kings, who has excellent relations with the Pope. He actually got a stipend from the Pope, although he had a very critical way of writing about the church. And his Dutch character, I hesitate to say, but I have to say it here, his Dutch character came through when he was asked to defend first Luther, when he was challenged over his church reformation. At that point, Erasmus said that he would not step forward to defend what he called a crude peasant. But it got worse when his close friend, Thomas More, was executed. And people prevailed on Erasmus to speak out and defend his friend, and he then said that he was not available. So, in that sense, the old barbarism still has stubborn advocates, but John will agree with me that courage here was not exactly the characteristic that made him stand out. Let me quickly move on now to the second episode, because what we've seen is that a new space is created, that a humanist party, as it were, begins to form itself in the interstices between states and a larger economic space. And that process, of course, is completed when, in England, with the Glorious Revolution, the state withdraws from the sphere of economic organization and allows its subjects to take all the initiatives in the sphere of enterprise that they want. And between the Glorious Revolution of 1688, which is the triumph of liberalism in the English lands, and the French Revolution, exactly a century later, we have the period that is called the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment is the period in which ideas of liberalism, sometimes overdrawn ideas, resonate in Scotland, in France, later in Germany, and so on and so forth, and people have ideas about freedom which tend to go beyond what the English actually thought about freedom, because they had a very narrowly calibrated idea. And the party, the transnational class, now begins to take a real shape, and that shape is of Freemasonry. Freemasonry is not exclusively the transnational capitalist class, but at that time it was the transnational liberal party, you might say. And you can see that in this picture, which is by a painter who was a contemporary of the famous French revolutionary painter David. This is by Regnault, who is, well, to me he was unknown, but I've read that he was as famous in his day as was David. And here you see the Enlightenment, more specifically the Spirit of France, as it's called in the painting, because it was painted 4 years into the Revolution. At the right, you see the dark forces of the Middle Ages. So the Enlightenment really brings light into a world which is darkened by superstition, etc. And on the left, you see a woman holding up a Phrygian cap, which is the sign of the of French democracy, and a Masonic instrument, which is the triangle with the lead weight added to it. And as you may know, in Freemasonry, the idea of a perfect world created after the model of geometry was actually the lodestar. Of course, today we tend to think of Freemasonry more in terms of the Da Vinci Code as a world of dark, superstitious conspiracies, etc. And there are still Freemasons around, and it's one way I've been told of getting a good second-hand BMW for a prize, which is really very competitive. But in this period, we're looking at the transnational liberal party. And everybody who was something wanted to be in that party, because people felt that if we would apply the freedoms that the English state had allowed its society to be entrepreneurial active, we would also be able to overcome, ideally without revolution, the rule of the aristocracy. That indeed is what happened in many cases. You might say that the Masonic lodges constituted a sort of social structure in which the class compromise between the declining but commercially and liberally minded aristocracy and the ascendant merchant class took place. So where usually the richest merchants and the most modern minded aristocrats who found each other in these Masonic lodges. But there was also a very strong element of the spread of science, the idea of constituting a bridge between the Academy of Sciences and a broader bourgeois audience. There was a very strong idea about the arts. You know, you may have heard that Haydn and Mozart, for instance, as composers, were both members of their respective Masonic lodges. And if Haydn was a bit skeptical about it, Mozart was very enthusiastic because, being Jewish, he was deeply attracted to the idea of an environment which had the charming secrecy that was attractive to his playful mind, but also was officially committed to overcoming racial prejudice and concern about your particular religious denomination. Now, Holland and England have a very important connection when it comes to Freemasonry, because Masonry was an invention of the English liberals. It's often called Scottish, but you may be reassured that it actually had nothing to do with Scotland. Although they spoke of the Scottish Rite, it was really an English invention. And the first foreign country in which a Masonic lodge was set up was actually Holland in 1730. And in 1730, the first lodges in Amsterdam and The Hague were set up by English people who had come over for the occasion, you know, robes, secret handshakes, all the jazz that comes with it was being executed there. But interestingly enough, the Dutch Masonic lodges were immediately suppressed by the States General, the Parliament of Provinces, because it was felt that the Masonic lodges were secret bodies committed to the restoration of the Orange Party. And the Orange Party were the descendants of William of Orange, who had come to Britain as, sort of higher, a rented king, you might say, in 1688, who had died in 1702. And after that, the Dutch, who were very wary of having a strong central authority, actually resisted having another Orange stadtholder. So it took until 1747 before the Oranges were back in office again. And that was thanks to the work of a family called the Bentincks. And here we go back in time a little bit. To the left you see William of Orange, William III in Holland, King William in England. And you see him here with his boyhood friend William Bentinck. And the Bentincks are really a very fascinating family that I have 2 minutes to devote myself to now, because it would take too long to see all the ramifications here. But what makes them so interesting is that these people accompanied William to England. In England, they were generously rewarded for their support. They became Dukes of Portland, got fantastic estates, you know, really Madonna-sized landed palaces. And later Bentincks of the same family became Prime Minister of Britain and the first Governor General of India. So we're really looking at a powerful family. But the interesting thing is that one branch of the Bentincks actually stayed behind and formed a privileged channel of English-Dutch collusion. So there were also Bentincks who were the accompanying who were the counselors and advisors to William IV, the successor stadtholder in Holland. And in the mid 18th century, Anton Bentinck, it will reassure you, was actually the Grand Master of Dutch Freemasonry, which by that time had been restored to its full power. Now you might say, what has this all to do with transnational class, with the divide between state, you know, territorial state boundaries on the one hand, and the international capital markets that were beginning to take shape in this period on the other. Now, what it has is that Holland at this period was a declining power, as you may well know. So whereas England was a bulwark of entrepreneurial initiative. They had discovered their own routes to the Americas, and although they were temporarily distracted by robbing foreign fleets in the area of Barbados and Jamaica, at some point they came back to North America again in the form of the settlements by Raleigh and his half-brother Humphrey Gilbert and other people, and of course the Puritan colonies that were created later. So North America became very important for Britain. It became a connection, a transatlantic connection for Britain, which gave it important inputs in its economic development. Holland, on the other hand, was declining. It lost its position in trade. It lost its manufacturers. The Dutch craftsmen actually left their domicile and went to the Baltic and to North Germany and other places. And Dutch money, which had accumulated thanks to its earlier commercial success, began to flow to England, to the point where, and here I have to consult my notes, where one-fifth of the British public debt at the end of the 18th century was in Dutch hands, and some 15 million guilders, which was roughly the equivalent of something like 15 billion pounds today, flowed annually into Dutch coffers coming from British sources. And here you can see a moment earlier in the century, actually, because this is, as you can see from the wicks, which are not yet the powdered ones of the late 18th century, but here you can see a stock market crisis in Amsterdam, and there's a long list of the fictitious investment objects that were exposed in this crisis. You know, islands, gold mines, and overseas fishing areas that actually, on inspection, turned out not to exist. And there's a great commotion here, of course, because people were very upset finding out that their money had gone into these fictitious investments. Now, for the upper class, that didn't make too much of a difference, because, as still is the case today, stock market crises are especially painful to the small investor, but somehow are a magical means of enlarging the possessions of the large investors, and it was exactly the case in this period as well, that the people who were part of these Masonic networks that connected Britain to the Netherlands actually profited from these repeated crises. And if this story that I used as a small anecdote tells us anything about the Bentincks, it is that there were literally families of people who were together, held together in these Masonic networks, who were close to the royal families in both on both sides of the North Sea, who served as a channel to get Dutch funds into English enterprise. And that, of course, on balance, impoverished the Dutch. It crystallized, it fossilized the Dutch class structure into another typical Dutch trait, which is the obsession of the Dutch with titles and with rank. Because although on the one hand Holland is a more egalitarian society than Britain, there's a curious thing that whereas in Britain you very quickly, and well, it has been my own experience, that very quickly you are on first-name terms. You know, there's apparently no rank involved, and yet you're also very soon aware that behind this facade of camaraderie there is a solid class structure that cannot be moved a centimeter. In Holland, it's exactly the other way around. In Holland, there is a deep egalitarianism, but much greater formality in the sense that, you know, whereas here you don't bandy around with a title like professor and doctor. In Holland, you're only something when you're professor, doctor, engineer, master, which is a legal title, and they even found a series of titles specially dedicated for people who are doing vocational training, because they felt aggrieved that they didn't have their own titles. Now, that's very odd if you think about it, because we're looking at such an egalitarian society. That goes back to a number of sources, but one major source really was this episode when the Dutch flexible mobile and class structure began to fossilize and to harden into an upper layer associated with the Orange family, the Masonic networks connected to England, you know, the upper class financiers, the regents, as they were called in Holland, and a smaller bourgeoisie, which had missed out on an industrial revolution because that didn't take place, who saw its commercial chances diminish, and who also were being weeded out with every stock market crisis. And these people became the party of the so-called patriots, and they became the party also who looked to France for salvation. And the interesting thing is that the English used the Dutch Freemason network to act as spying operations in France, but also to do things like, for instance, translating Locke's two treatises of government, you know, the great book of liberal rule. The two treatises were translated in Amsterdam under the auspices of the Dutch Freemasonry, the Amsterdam Freemason Lodge. And it was a fabricated translation. So, for instance, terms like commonwealth and civil society were translated by words in French as république, you know, which was a quite radical interpretation because Locke had never been a republican, of course. But this was because the English were concerned that French power might expand and that it might at some point lead to the annexation of the Netherlands. And that, of course, also caused concern in the Netherlands. Now, all this ended with the French occupation, the French Revolution, of course. The actual patriots in Holland revolted 4 years before the French Revolution took place. But since the queen at the time in Holland, or the wife of the stadtholder, was a Prussian princess, she was able to call in her brother with an army. And, well, the Dutch, not being too courageous, immediately gave up the fight, and some 40,000 patriots, people, you know, from the artisan classes and the bourgeoisie, fled to France only to return with the French armies in 1795. And before France intervened, of course, they wanted to be sure about the Dutch national character, and this is my last quote, and the report that came back, you know, about what sort of resistance the French armies might expect. The report specified that the Dutch people are always inclined to side with the strongest, prone to plunder and drink, noisy when it rebels, but terrified by the sight of bayonets or just a few miserable bailiffs, inclined to argument, but with little education. So by now you understand that I'm pretty worked up being a Dutch professor in England, because so many much more illustrious people than me have explained that we are a people without education, basically for sale, and, well, deeply frightened for any show of force. Now, this takes me to the last episode, and that is the contemporary period. And, of course, now we're really talking about a transnational capitalist class which operates in between formally constituted states which have their explicit boundaries. And the way to look at that, the way to look at the class now, is, for instance, in this way. Here you see the Dutch, the structure of Dutch capital in 1959 in terms of interlocking directorates. And after this I will show a few more of these pictures, but then more recent ones about the contemporary period and the international structure. The point that I want to show here is that Unilever in this picture was, of course, an Anglo-Dutch company, as was Koninklijke Olie Shell, Royal Dutch Shell. So they in themselves already represent an Anglo-Dutch connection. And Unilever was connected, of course, to various people in the political sphere here in the 1950s. And they were connected to the Rotterdamse Bank, and via the Rotterdamse Bank to Philips. So Philips and Unilever formed a separate bloc with the Rotterdamse Bank in the Dutch economy and in Dutch politics. Now, you might say, what should we worry about that? The interesting thing is that Unilever really is a company that is not just here for anecdotal reasons. It is it was the linchpin of making the connection between Atlantic and European politics on the one hand and the Atlantic economy that was taking shape after the Second World War. And this process began when Dutch politicians and businessmen were exiled in London during the Second World War, and people from Unilever were prominent. First of all, Paul Reikens, who was Mr. Margarine, so to speak, and next to him, Jan Willem Beyen, who is by any measure the father of the contemporary EU, together with Paul-Henri Spaak from Belgium. Now, Unilever was a company with very important interest in Germany, although it was an Anglo-Dutch company. And the main concern of the people who were sitting together in wartime London to discuss post-war planning for the Dutch government was how to reintegrate Germany after the war into a sort of Atlantic economy. And that explains to a considerable extent the role that Beyen would later play in launching the European, the EEC at first. But the interesting thing is that while he was doing that, his fellow director, Paul Reikens, was bringing together in 1953-54 his former friends from wartime London to discuss the growing rift in the Atlantic domain between Western Europe and the United States, because in the United States at the time there was the McCarthy witch hunt. In Europe that was not much appreciated, and Reikens therefore brought Prince Bernhard, his friend from London, and a few others together in what became the Bilderberg Conferences. And the Bilderberg Conferences are the network in which this connection between politics and the economy is made. Now let me go quickly to the more contemporary. I'll come back to the Bilderberg later. In 1973, there was actually a new organization branching off from Bilderberg, which also included the Japanese contingent, and that was the Trilateral Commission, and also the World Economic Forum, which is convening next week in Davos again, was set up in the early 70s as a broader and more open network. Now, if we look at the network of joint directorates, and here we come to some research of varying quality that I've done. First myself, which is the weakest part, because this I did from a book about the 100 most internationally active corporations in the world. We then turned to the network for 2000. That was already a much bigger job because it's based on the 150 top firms listed in the Financial Times of that year as the richest in assets. And finally we get to the 2005. This is still a bit incomplete, because it was done by Aura Viv on a British Academy grant that we got last year. And I can assure you that you really need a grant to do all the work, to have one illustration, basically. Now, let me just go over these three pictures of differing validity and different working hours that have gone into them. Here you see those connections in terms of interlocking directorates between companies that are at minimum two directors. So they're always companies that are linked by two or more directors, and these have been put together in what I call a cluster. It gives you some sense of a sort of continent of business, because these are really the meaningful connections, you might say, because there are no companies in the world which have two directors in common, and where there is not a thing like either a participation of ownership or a strategic alliance. And even if you didn't have a strategic alliance, there are, of course, a necessary collusion. Because with two people listening in the board meetings of one company, the other board is also perfectly informed. And that's what we're looking at. We're looking at an information structure. And it is these sort of information structures where, let's say, a consensus in terms of the longer-term orientation of the business world is taking shape, where maverick opinions are being weeded out, and where also the ideas about the direction of the political process are being discussed, because these, of course, are of vital importance to the various companies involved. And, of course, as you can see, these are all blue-chip corporations. Now, the interesting thing is that in Europe, there were never such networks between the different countries. Holland was always the bridge between an Atlantic network on the one hand and Germany. But between Germany, France, Italy, and the other countries, there were no such combinations. Now, if we look at, so this is the end of the Cold War. If we look at 2000, you can see that the overwhelming position of the Atlantic network as an information structure, consensus-forming structure, if you will, in 2000 has given way to a situation where a more balanced picture emerges, in that now there are connections between the German network, which is the biggest blob on the right-hand side, the French network, which is connected, which is situated below that, and the Swiss network, which is now connected to the German and French. And that means that at this point, you cannot say that, as was the case in 1992 and in all the years before it, there was an overwhelming Atlantic emphasis in the network of interlocking directories, because here we're looking at a more even-handed situation. But note the position there of Allianz in the German network. Well, this is a point in my story where I'm always afraid that my enthusiasm may run ahead of yours, because, of course, I've been reading around this a little bit. And for instance, what I found out is that Allianz is not at all, as we think, just an insurance company. It is today's powerhouse of the German economy. It has vast participations in industry, in other banks, etc., because Deutsche Bank, which used to have that role, has branched off and become an almost London-based investment bank now, after some legislative changes making that possible. And why I'm saying that is because in 2005 you can see that Allianz has branched out to connect with two directors or more to some of the most important American banks like J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, just as Deutsche Telekom has two connections to Citigroup. So a new structure has emerged. And what is very important here is that we realize that whatever changes in the business world, at the same time also changes in, there are also changes in the political world. And what changed between 2000 and 2005, of course, is that the United States engaged in its war on terror in response to 9/11. When it did that, it introduced all kind of restricting measures to, for instance, business visits. It becomes more and more difficult to get into the United States. Now, I can tell you that the people who are directors at this level will not be kept at the plane and sent back because of some mistake in their youth. But it works, of course, against the facilitation of American influence in the world if you have so many restrictions. And that is why the former head of Goldman Sachs, who is now United States Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, has openly called for an end to the restrictions to business travel that are in place for the U.S. Now, the final thing that I have was actually made by myself last Thursday, and that is back to the Dutch, the Anglo-Dutch connection again. And here you see how the bridge function of a transnational class between, on the one hand, the transnational capitalist world, and on the other hand, the separated national spheres of each state is operating. Because you see which Dutch and British company directors are represented on the Bilderberg and on its much larger outgrowth, the Trilateral Commission, and how these connections are then, how this commission and the Bilderberg Conference are then connected to crucial places. Note both in both cases the royal family, the Ministry of Defense in Britain, of course a number of lords, Foreign Commonwealth or Office, and even the University of Warwick is there represented in this network, just as the University of Leiden, but it's a long story to explain why they are there. Let me wrap up here. The point that I want to make is that all through history, there has been a bridging role of a transnational class to connect the economic and the political sphere. It is not so that economics is determined by politics, or what is even more more familiar idea, the other way around, you know, that politics is just something which is played by the real forces in the economy. In fact, to have these two systems of forces, these two structural arenas connected into one moving system, of which we think, for instance, when we say the expansion of the West, we have to see that there are two different logics at work. One is open, requires open spaces, smooth passages across borders. The other requires the exclusive jurisdiction of one state. For these different structures to expand in one process, there has to be a connecting mechanism, and the connecting mechanism are, for instance, these networks. And I shouldn't forget that next week we're looking at the meeting of the World Economic Forum, which of course is a much more grandiose and open and network which also seeks publicity. And what we get there is not a conference, as this is in last weekend's Guardian. It's not a conference, as Klaus Schwab, reason why some 3,000 people get together in Davos to be there for 5 days. But he says it is a multi-stakeholder network of global decision makers. And these really are the people who are active there. He also, the article also explains, you know, Tony Blair will be there to give a talk on leadership, and there's a malicious passage where the newspaper says he may also be soliciting some people for the next holiday address he might need. But the other point that is interesting in this article is that it's not just about business and politics, but it's really about everything that is moving under the sun. For instance, there are lectures about recent brain research, etc., because if you want to be in power, you have to control all aspects of life and society. And the question that arises inevitably, of course, are these people really all powerful? Aren't we in the end just looking at some cooked up version of another conspiracy theory? And the answer, of course, is, I hope, is no. Because if we understand these networks as networks of information, the question that I haven't answered at all is which information is circulated in these networks. And what is circulating, of course, is not just a self-congratulation of free markets and great profits, but is an assessment of the challenges that this economic system faces. And that is why, if there is an opposition and there is an alternative, because we live in an age in which this alternative is making itself known for the first time in the form of the anti-globalization movement, and even if that has now been reduced somewhat, we have new things like the social movement, unionism, for instance, of which my own daughter is one of the representatives, which is taking its place. And I think it's really a sign of our times that if we, on the one hand, understand a picture like this, which is only a fragment of the total picture, as a structure of power, we always have to think of it at the same time as operating under the shadow of a potential opposition that operates on the same plane. And that was the point I would try to make. Now, at the end of this, I hope you forgive me if I think back for a second to my parents, of course, who, as I said at the beginning, we came from very small background. I was brought up in a spirit of humility. You were in our place, you were not allowed to speak about yourself under any circumstances. At the same time, there was a spirit of ambition, the idea that we should get ahead and not stay in the place where we were at that time, and actually we didn't, because my father did go bankrupt and we had to move. He was literally proletarianized. I thank them for everything that I am. There's also somebody else who, without whom I wouldn't have been here, but she has insisted that she not be mentioned under any circumstances. And so be it. Thank you.